Hello and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I'm Craig Dale, the Head of Policy and Research at Commonweal. We've almost reached the end of 2023. Another year in Commonweal done and plenty of work to show for it. We've published 18 policy papers, hundreds of newsletter articles, and we've taken part in dozens of public events and talks. We've even got more than a couple of successful political campaigns under our belt this year too. So here, to round off 2023 with the final podcast of this year, to talk to me is our director, Amanda Berger. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Hello, Craig, and thank you for inviting me.
So 2023 started with a bang back in January with an update to our scrutiny of the ScotWind project. How significant has that been to the discourse around Scotland's public renewable resources?
So, well, firstly, I need to say that in January, around the same time, we were actually having a long conversation about how much output we'd had the previous year, and saying, oh, 2023 needs to go a bit slower. We need to take more time over things, make sure that everything gets the publicity it deserves. And I think no sooner had I said that than we launched straight into ScotWind, which had an amazing amount of media coverage. I think it did several things. It certainly brought Commonweal to a group of people that maybe didn't know about us before. But in terms of the renewables industry within Scotland and how people perceive it, I think that there was a great deal of dialogue came on the back of our work and being picked up by other media outlets. So overall, I think it was a very positive thing. The downside of it, of course, is that it's not really a good news story. And I don't know how you would summarize it, but I would say this shows that we are not actually putting our own natural resources to work for Scotland in the way that we should.
This paper, this was an update to the paper I wrote in January 2022 when it was announced. And it was tracking not just how much was actually being invested in Scotland. We had the politicians up saying, oh, this will bring billions of pounds in supply chain benefits for Scotland. So even though we don't own any of the resources that will be generated here with this project, we'll still get all the economic benefit of it being built here. And I went through the numbers and found that actually only about a third of the total investment of the entire project will happen in Scotland. Most of it is happening elsewhere. And most of the high value ongoing stuff is happening elsewhere. So Scotland might get some of the jobs installing the wind turbines, but we're not manufacturing the bulk of them. We're not doing the R&D. We're not doing the ongoing operational stuff. And the promises involved are very easily broken. So if it's cheaper to take those supply chain promises away and do even more of the manufacturing elsewhere, that's going to happen. So yeah, you're right. It was an important news story, but not a good news story.
Exactly my thoughts. Yeah, very much. And I think it's quite interesting that, you know, almost a year on from your second venture into ScotWind, we've now got more decisions to be making. And I think this is maybe a story for 2024, but the pylons that are proposed for the Northeast and how that affects communities and what have you, which I see as very much a part of the bigger renewables picture in Scotland. We know why people want infrastructure of a specific type. We don't really understand who benefits from it, or we're not seeing the benefit to Scotland. So that'll be an interesting one for next year.
This is a story that, I mean, the grid is having to reconfigure itself. It was based formerly on the idea that you had these big centralized power stations and you could get on a train with the coal carts to take the fuel to the station. That doesn't work with renewable energy, with wind. So we're going to have to reconfigure the grid. That means more pylons, more cables running from the north of Scotland down through Scotland and further south. And it's how we do that in a way that benefits or at least doesn't harm communities as those pylons pass through.
Absolutely. And the other thing that we're seeing, that I'm seeing locally, is battery storage attached to the substations. And that's really changing the wind picture as well, I think. But again, not really clear how that fits into rural communities.
Yeah, and that's actually a big story in my area too, where we have an application for Scotland's largest solar farm just on the edge of our village, a 100 megawatt solar project with another 100 megawatts worth of batteries installed to that. So that's a very substantial battery storage site there too. It comes with all those safety implications and noise implications. And I've written about this, and I'm going to be writing about this more next year. The community is getting very involved in applying scrutiny to this project to make sure that, again, it doesn't harm the community and provides the maximum benefit to the community.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing's for sure, is that renewables are such an important part of Scotland's economy, but also have such a direct impact on our communities, that this isn't going to be a story that has an end. It's an ongoing saga. So I think people can expect even more from us on that.
Yeah. So in a somewhat related campaign, we've also been involved in a campaign called SAP, Scotland Against Public-Private Partnerships. These are your PFIs and other related three-letter abbreviations that nobody really understands what they actually mean. Is Scotland still relying too much on private finance for public infrastructure? And what's that doing for our public assets?
I think it's really interesting to think that we think it's normal to use private money for public infrastructure. If we go back to the early days of, I don't know, the coal board or something, it was never at that time considered appropriate that our power infrastructure would be privately owned. Mm-hmm. And now we're borrowing money hand over fist for all kinds of things. And we've even got private money coming in for tree planting and what have you. So some of this is ideological, of course. And so I would say I'm not in favor of private money being used for public infrastructure. But I also know people who would plead the opposite and say, but that actually is a good use of funds and allows us to do more. I just don't like the dependency on the private money and the opportunity that that creates for any profits to be taken out of Scotland rather than staying here within our public sector, because it is basically a drain on public sector finance.
And that was the finding of the paper we published on this earlier this year, that it wasn't just the profits coming out of Scotland. They were actually flowing directly into tax havens. And the thing in that paper that really caught my attention was that even if you do all the good work practices when you're procuring these deals and you get the most ethical company possible to build your hospital or your school or whatever, they often then just flip the project once it's completed, sell it to someone else, and that someone else is a tax haven hedge fund.
I think that there are better ways of raising public finance for infrastructure projects than relying on private money and the risks that that brings. But we need to have the willingness to do that. And there doesn't seem to be much willingness to do big public infrastructure projects at the moment.
Yeah, I don't want to get into the weeds of what is a very technical paper, but the criticisms we've had recently around the fiscal framework for devolution that puts limits on Scottish Government borrowing, and how that was renegotiated this year but didn't lead to more borrowing powers that would have led to less reliance on PFI projects. So that's another campaign for us to take forward in the next year.
Absolutely, and I'm looking forward to that one. I would say that you're saying it's very technical. I think that it's been written in a way that makes it quite comprehensible. So I don't want people to be put off. I want them to go and look at that paper.
So, political world was rocked in March with the resignation of Nicola Sturgeon. And we then had several weeks of an SNP leadership contest. We're not getting involved in the ins and outs of that. We're non-party. So that's for others to dive into in detail. But what were your thoughts on how that panned out overall? Was that an opportunity for more focus on policies, or did it just end up more of the same style over substance that we get from too many other politicians?
I think it was, for those of us who are interested in politics, it was certainly an interesting couple of weeks. I found the debate to be not totally engaging. I think that the way that the leadership debates were run didn't really give us any in-depth policy development of ideas and things like that. But I think it was quite engaging for those of us who do follow party politics to see what the options were. Now, was there a really great difference between the three candidates? I think probably fewer differences than we might have imagined. But because we didn't get that policy debate, we didn't really understand whether there were different options or whether it was just different people.
A slightly more engaging debate, one of Commonweal's big successes this year, was around the National Care Service. Again, it was not really building something positive, but stopping something negative. The first draft of the National Care Service bill came out, and a lot of people who looked at it, including us, including the STUC, a lot of the local authorities, saw this as a power grab, as taking care away from local authorities and investing it into one person, the care minister. We successfully campaigned with the STUC to pause that bill and reconsider. Is this showing the power of think tanks in politics?
I think it's showing that bad ideas can be shown to be bad ideas. And I think that one of the reasons that the campaign was successful is that it was very obviously an effort to centralize yet another thing, and that people are worried about over-centralization. So I don't want to diminish the work of the campaign, but I do think it was perceived in this bigger concept of how what's local and what's centralized. And people do not want, in general, centralized services. They want to know that it's available for them locally. I have to say that our care reform group, which is a group of professionals who all volunteer weekly, they have impressed me so much over the last year, especially the work that they are doing constantly. I don't know how many papers they've put out over the last 2 years, Craig. You maybe have a better handle on that. But I just see how much effort and time and real expertise goes into those papers. We've got another one coming out in the newsletter this week. You know, they're constantly tweaking and finding a better way of doing things, or bringing our attention to the things that aren't currently working. And it's so important to have that kind of body doing that. So, yes, that is part of the power of a think tank, but only because our particular think tank is backed up by some really, really strong people who work in that particular area and have got great understanding.
And I have to say, from me, also the work that you don't see in print from them. They're constantly engaging with people in the sector. They're lobbying the unions and local government, lobbying national government as well. Actually, that led to something quite funny this year, where we discovered a flaw in the Scottish government's idea of transparency in their lobbying register, where we were trying to register how much we were talking to government. And we actually had to delete several of our records because it was the care group who were doing the lobbying. They're not paid by Commonweal. Therefore, we're not allowed to tell you that they were lobbying. It was a weird situation.
I remember that well, and it is so bizarre where, you know, we're trying very hard to be as transparent as possible, only to be told, no, we don't want your transparency. We don't want you to tell us about these things. Only tell us when you absolutely have to. Yeah. It's a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah. How many other people are being told they're not allowed to tell the public how they're lobbying, or how many people are deliberately using that loophole? We can't know.
I mean, we already voluntarily notify, given the size of Commonweal. I think it's if you're under 10 employees, you're actually not compelled to fill that register anyway. But in the interest of transparency, we've always believed it was important. How useful is a lobbying register if it's not complete?
This year, we've seen a lot of discussion around the well-being economy. We've seen some misunderstanding of what that means as well. What does well-being mean to you, and is the Scottish Government getting it right?
So I think, first of all, I have to say I hate the phrase. And the reason that I hate the phrase well-being economy is because it is so easily misunderstood by people who are not directly involved with it. So what do I mean by that? So because we talk about health and well-being all the time, I know I've talked to people who sort of assume that this is an economy that's based around health. And I've seen some really interesting things on the back of that, like funding applications for projects because they will make people feel better as part of the well-being economy. So I think it's, for people who are interested in policy or in economics, then I think it's fairly clear what we mean. But for people who don't have that background, I don't think it's a clear message of what it is that we're trying to achieve. And so one of the things where it's coming up quite a lot is in some of our land work, where if you were to apply the well-being economy to land, you'd start off with a landscape that was untouched by humans and then work from there so that any economic or other activity had to bear in, take into account what was going wrong. I was at the Scotonomics conference earlier this year, and there was a lot of discussion about it there. That was in Dundee. It was a really useful couple of days. I think you spoke there as well.
Yep, I did.
And that was really nice. I'm looking forward to that happening again next year. I think that we've sort of got to a situation where everybody's accepted that we are moving towards the well-being economy without necessarily understanding what the economic tests for that are. And so that's something that I hope will be clearer in people's minds. And I think that's a role for Commonweal as well. We're constantly going out and talking to groups. And I know that from many of the groups I've spoken with, that's one of the subjects that they would like to, us to talk about. So if anybody's listening and they would like their group to have a bit of a primer on well-being economy, then they should just get in touch.
Yeah, I mean,
delighted to go and talk to them.
Yep, absolutely. Something we do a lot of in Commonweal, more so this year than the previous couple of years for obvious reasons. But it's been good to see that kind of pick up again. I have to say my big frustration about the well-being economy is that, strictly speaking, what that says is that an economy should be there to improve your well-being, regardless of what the shape of that economy is or how it grows or doesn't grow. Whereas there's too many people think that what it means is, no, we still need that growing economy, but it has to be a bit nicer. And that I don't like that. Also, sometimes, as you say, with that project you mentioned, often it can come across as, well, it just means doing the economy as we've always done, but paying a bit more attention to fixing the problems it causes, rather than how about changing the economy so that it doesn't cause those problems in the first place.
Yeah, and the growth degrowth argument is one that we're not really spending enough time on.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to use some of these catchphrases, and if you don't drill down into what that actually means, then you never get to have the discussion about why do we want growth? Why do we not want growth?
Yeah.
That's something that's close to our hearts, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, we've got a series of papers, not from this year, but from previous years, called Resilience Economics, that really goes into that idea of what an economy is for, beyond or even despite growth as a goal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So we published a new book this year amongst all the policy papers and everything else. Tell us why we in the independence movement need some direction.
Because we don't have any, in a simple phrase. I think So it's really interesting because I talk to people from various different political parties and those who belong to none, but who are fundamentally supporters of independence and want it to happen right now, and they're running out of patience. And so we get this situation where there's a lot of disquiet and a lot of annoyance and frustration, but people have not got a route to it. So we can talk about the constitutional issues as much as we like, but unless there is a route to actually take that forward, it counts for naught, really. So I think that's really the purposing behind us issuing a book called Direction is, well, where are we and what do we do next? And I think that the independence movement doesn't need some figurehead or, you know, a leader per se, but it does need to have some direction and a route, a map for where we go next. And hopefully that book will do some of that for people. It's not saying, here's your leader, follow them. It's, these are the things that need to take place.
You say, if you can hear some rumbling noises in the background, it's not traffic, it's Nero, one of the policy podcasts, has decided to join me and is purring away ferociously. So she's been a regular guest in the show for the last couple of years.
We're up to what, 4 policy podcasts now?
Yes, 4 of them now. We had another one join us a year ago, a wee boy called Jinx, who was abandoned with his litter mates in a back alley, was discovered and brought into care and came to us from there. He's a wee terror, but we love him.
What would we be without our pets?
Yeah. So, back to the policies.
Back to policy, Craig.
I think part of our work isn't so much new policy papers, but getting that word into the ears of government. And one of the angles we use to do that is public consultations. As thankless as a task it can often be, I've written more than a few of them. Why should the public get involved with public consultations, and what happens if we don't?
Well, I think we've all heard the phrase, you get the government you deserve. And consultations are one opportunity to make your voice heard to government. I think that there's sometimes a feeling that consultations are meaningless. And I'm not talking just about Scottish government level, but I know how many communities feel that they're on this carousel of one charabanc after the other. You know, everything's a consultation, and that, yet does anything change on the back of it? And for me, that's the important thing about consultations, is not just that the consultation takes place and that people are allowed to have their say on policy matters, but that that consultation is then enacted. So it's absolutely no point just doing the first part of gathering the data if you don't then do something about it. And the more people who take part in a consultation, the more weight there is behind that information, and the more likely it is that it will be enacted. So from that perspective, I would say everybody please do, however frustrating it sometimes can seem, consultations are a really important part of our process. And I think you'll remember the land reform consultations that we did with big Zoom meetings some time ago, and how many people actually took part in those, because I think issues like land reform, where people are actually really passionate about it, those consultations were really useful, and they ran alongside the ones that the government was doing for themselves. So that was a really good opportunity of showing just how many people cared about the issue, and what those people actually felt should happen. And so I'm a big fan of consultations if they're done right. But once a consultation is published, it's also an opportunity for us to then hold government to account and say, but the consultation said this, How have you interpreted that?
Yeah, that land reform consultation is actually a really good example, because just this week, the official report on that consultation was due, but has been delayed until next year to give the Scottish Government more time to examine and take on the views that were submitted. So I can only imagine that they got a few of them.
I think that, yes. I personally know of a lot of people who responded to that one. So, yeah, so that was really good. It was also, I think, exemplary from Commonweal in the way that we did our own activities alongside. I was quite proud of, first, the fact that we managed to do that, but also the number of people that we engaged with to make sure that our views were well informed.
And sticking on the subject of land reform, one of the fun engagements we had just in the last month, in November there, you mentioned the Scotonomics conference earlier this year. There was a Revive conference on grouse shooting and land reform that we both were at. We were both on stage talking. What were your experiences of that?
I think it was fantastic. It was great to see 700 people in Perth Concert Hall. I think that probably Chris Packham was the big draw for that. I know that I have family members who would not have come to see you and me, but would turn up to see Chris Packham. So they came along. But in terms of the substance of the day, it's really, really clear that there is a general feeling against all forms of shooting, but particularly the way that the driven grouse moors operate and the effect that that has on the biodiversity of our hillside, the actual look of our hillside itself, and things like Muir Burn, which from an environmental perspective, you know, just burning off all this stuff to make it a bit easier for little chicks to get around, and the environmental damage that that does is well worth talking about. So those things came out really clearly in the Revive conference. After that, as part of the Revive coalition, we were also involved last week with a reception at the Scottish Parliament, where we were making the case to MSPs and to others who came along. And that was very well received as well. We had quite a few MSPs talking with us about the issues. And that, of course, is drumming up support for the bill that is passing through. And that's all very good. And where does it go beyond that? Well, hopefully the bill, but also as a coalition, we have decided that this actually now pivots towards land reform in general. So the same coalition that has been very successful, I would say, in our campaign to date about grouse moors and shooting and wildlife management, is now going to pivot and focus all of that attention onto land reform for 2024. And for me, that looks like a very exciting year, because it will, again, tie in with legislation being discussed at Holyrood.
Yeah, I'm personally really looking forward to that land reform bill coming back and then scrutinising it, taking it apart, putting it back together again. And finally, maybe this time, after decades, we'll actually get a bit of decent land reform in Scotland that will bring us up to what the rest of Europe calls normal.
I mean, yes, I think it is not normal for fewer than 500 people to own the whole land in the land in a country. And we all know that. We all, you know, and we all know that it doesn't work very well for communities, that the contribution to the rural economy could be different if the land ownership was different. And yet we haven't up to this point seen any significant change. It's been a promise for a long time. It's been a long time coming. Hopefully 2024 will really do something about that.
That brings us almost to the end of the show. I've been talking as if we've actually stopped working for the rest of the year. It's not quite true. We have one more policy paper coming out on green retrofitting for houses. I'm not going to talk too much more about that because it's out tomorrow and I don't want to spoil it. But apart from that, what is next for Commonweal in 2024?
Well, I've mentioned the land reform. We'll certainly have a big focus on land reform. We also want to do more work on local democracy, because these two things, they're so intertwined. And this is something that during my time with Commonweal, I've really begun to notice or recognize just how much. So that when you start talking about policy, you can't just go and tweak a little bit over there and it fixes things. Because as soon as you start tweaking one area, it has implications elsewhere. And we really are looking at an entire system of government rather than just one-off policies. So the things that I'm really looking forward to, like the land reform bill, do tie into local democracy. If you're going to have a method of land ownership that involves communities, then our current large local authority area isn't the best mechanism for helping that take part. So we'll have a lot of that. We'll be continuing and possibly doing a little bit more in terms of our newsletters and the written articles that people can subscribe to. I think you and I have talked about bringing back a sort of monthly policy long read,
mm-hmm.
That people might look forward to. We've got our health and education working groups running. So I think the health paper is now going to be early 2024, is my understanding. I think we've got quite a big piece of work already done on that, but it's just about scheduling and making sure we get it right. So people should look forward to that. I don't know. What else are you up to? Tell us what you're looking forward to.
Oh, well, again, don't want to give away too much on some of the policy papers on the deck, but we've got more work on retrofitting and how to do that at a national scale. We have papers on land, taxing land, to tie in with the land reform campaign. I've been looking at the level of foreign ownership in Scotland's economy and what that means for, again, as we were talking about public investment, but across the entire economy, what does it mean if the profits from your economy are flowing overseas? And while that for any other think tank would be enough for the entire year, I'm sure we'll come up with some more to publish from February onwards.
I'm sure we will. So looking back then, Craig, just personally, what are you most proud of from your work that you've done this year?
I think I have to say the ScotWind work, because that has been so substantial. There's a toss-up between that and the National Care Service, and I just have to say the National Care Service has mostly not been me, so I'm not claiming credit for it there. Yeah. Between those two projects, they really cemented an idea in my head that I want to be campaigning more for positive campaigns, because as important as it is to resist a bad idea, once mm-hmm. you succeed in that game and you successfully stop a bad idea, all you've done is made sure that tomorrow is the same as today. Whereas successfully completing a positive campaign, you have improved tomorrow. So both are important. I've been that idea in my head of really sort of finding those positive campaigns and then pushing for them is going to be a big part of my next year and going forward.
That sounds great. And perhaps some of your listeners, if they've got ideas about these positive campaigns and what could and what could improve things for tomorrow, maybe they'll get in touch with you, because
that really is a big thing for me. The last couple of years, I've been trying to put a theme on the podcast, and I've not stuck to it every single week, of course, but I had a really good one 2 years ago when I talked about communities, and I got people coming in from all over Scotland telling me about interesting projects that were happening in their campaign. This year, the theme was good news, and again, looking for those positive stories. Wasn't always successful every week, but I hope I managed to get enough out there to let people know that it wasn't all doom and gloom. Next year, I want the theme to be Activate. Tell me, get in touch. Please tell me, what are you campaigning on? even if it's a negative campaign, even if you're resisting a bad idea, but really get in touch. Tell me what is happening in your area that you're wanting to change, and I'll get you onto the show and we can talk about it.
Well, that sounds great. I shall really look forward to those. Yeah, well, I think 2024 is going to be another good year for Common Wheel. And thanks very much for bringing me on the show. I've really enjoyed chatting to you because we don't get to chat that often. We're too busy working.
We are indeed. Well, I'll hold you to that. I think the next time, the last couple of years, we've had a little growing tradition of getting the entire team onto the podcast for the first episode of the year to talk about things that have happened during the break. So I think that could be something to do in January.
Perfect.
Well, thank you, Amanda. It's been great talking to you. It's been great rounding off this year in Common Wheel with you.
It has.
And just to finish off, thank you to everybody who has listened to this podcast over the year. And just to remind you that Common Wheel as an organisation is entirely funded by folk like you. We don't get government money. We don't have corporate sponsors. We don't even have adverts on our website. So if you want to help support our policies, our campaigns, and this show, please click the donate link in the description of the show. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you to all of my listeners. Enjoy your winter break however you spend it. And I'll speak to you again next year. Thank you.